This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here through the hour to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, to share some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Want to talk with Zorba? Call 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Zorba, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Public Radio's favorite family doc. Happy birthday to you.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you very much.
You are 39 again.
And counting. That's exactly right. And for anyone who remembers that joke, you know you're over 39.
That's the truth. Okay, birthday boy, tell us about the topics we have.
Let's see. We're going to talk about chewing gum, how it's helpful after colon surgery.
Go away.
Wow. Mom was wrong. Chewing gum is good for you.
Okay.
Actually, my father was in the gum business for years, so I think about him every time I think about chewing gum.
Sure.
And one to two people, a number of people believe that prayer trumps a doctor's prognosis when it comes to patients who are critically ill.
Yeah, and a lot of docs think
absolutely
that as well.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk about that. And our heart healthy recipe is Myla's cabbage salsa.
Myla's going to be very unhappy.
Yeah, Myla's going to be unhappy. You know how it is with dyslexia. Easy come, easy go.
Okay, those coming up are medical myth buster as well, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. To the phones we go, Zorba, and our first caller, a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I was calling about to see if there's any kind of dietary or supplemental things I can do to help stimulate my memory.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had a really hard time remembering very important events in my life, like when I was younger, going to Disney with my family, no recollection, at the age around 8 or 9. Even as early as my senior year in high school, which was about 5 years ago, my friends all the time will say, oh, do you remember the time we went out here? And, you know, and I don't remember.
How's your short-term memory? Like what you did just?
Short-term is okay. It's just long-term. It's like things just go away. It just disappears.
let me test you. What's the name of the doctor on this program?
Zorba.
What's his last name?
Pastor.
Ah!
Well, you almost got me. Okay.
You see, it's like Groucho Marx. She won the secret word. She gets $100.
Yeah.
No, not really. Not really. How's your mood? Are you depressed, unhappy? Because depression and memory, interestingly enough, often co-link. One of the things that I look at in my office when I'm working is that when people say I've got a memory loss, if they have a memory loss, the first question is, are they depressed? Because often people who are depressed either have a loss of memory or they believe they have a loss of memory and they don't want to think about things in the past. Would that fit what's going on with you? Do you have any mood problems?
I've had problems with depression, mostly hormonal, throughout my adolescence and early adulthood. But a lot of the things, and I've thought about that before, that maybe I'm blocking out bad memories, but
sure.
I'm also losing a lot of good ones.
Right. No. But that's one of the things that can happen. Are you on any medications at all?
Not anymore. I have been on antidepressants before, and I've just not seen a whole lot of results from them, so I've tried to stay away from them for the most part.
Okay. When you were on antidepressants, did your memory change at all?
Not particularly.
Okay. Got it. I have a very specific suggestion. I think what you need to go is you need to find a therapist that engages in cognitive behavioral therapy. I think these memories are locked up. They're there. I don't think you need a tonic. I don't think you need ginseng or ginkgo. I don't think any of that is going to do anything. But I think what you need to do is sit down with a therapist. Might be 5 sessions, might be 10 sessions, so that you can basically keep memories that may be unpleasant, and they may be mood memories that are unpleasant. You can keep that on one side of your brain, if you will, and then you can find the other memories on the other side of your brain. I think that these memories are related to mood. That's what
okay.
I think. I think they're there. I think they're locked up. But I think what happens is often because of depression or anxiety, we just shut off whole sections of our brain because we don't want to go anywhere near the problems that exist. So we forget the good and we forget the bad.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you so much. I think I might have to go do that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
Memory's weird, Zorba. When you think back on things, do you see them as pleasant things usually, or do you see them as unpleasant?
Well, it kind of depends on the memory. I mean, when I was carjacked in Venezuela, I think of that as an unpleasant memory.
Oh, no, of course.
And when I, you know, and when I've gone on family vacations with my kids, which I did for a gazillion years, you know, 15, 20 years, 22 years, I think of those as good memories, of course. Now, some of them are neutral, but a lot of memories have emotional attachments.
I tend to select. When I think back on experiences that I know deep down were very mixed experiences, maybe even lots of unpleasant things in them, I remember the pleasant stuff. I'm thinking about Navy, military service years ago.
Okay. You think about the good stuff.
Right now I think, wow, what a wonderful four years that was.
Yes, but how about when you were in the Navy? Did you always
I thought it was. Wait, I can't wait to get out of here. So memory is a weird thing.
No, it is. It is. Selective memory is even weirder than that.
Because, as you said, you look back on things with pleasant memories.
But what she's doing is she's blocking out the whole thing.
Yeah.
So in other words, you're taking the Navy, thinking about those good years, blocking out the bad stuff and keeping the good stuff in your head.
Yeah.
She's blocking out the whole thing. That's what she's doing. Right. And they're there. It's not a brain problem. It's a mood problem. She's been on antidepressants. She can work on this and unlock those memories with a good therapist.
800-462-7413. Question for Zorba? We have a line open now for you at 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I thought you were singing happy birthday to me, but okay.
Oh, is it your birthday?
Oh, yeah, I'm going kind of crazy here. I'm cleaning the house.
Oh, on your birthday?
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing to do. You going to clean house, Zorba, today?
Nope. Nope, I'm not going to clean house on my birthday. No, I don't think so.
So how can we help you?
Okay, here's the situation. We've been trying to get pregnant for a while now, and now we got pregnant, and everything's going good except she wants me in the delivery room, and I was wondering, two questions, is what can I expect in the delivery room? And are the Lamaze classes actually for the guys where we don't hyperventilate or what?
Well, you're right on both cases. The Lamaze classes are so you don't hyperventilate. That's right.
I don't want to be in there.
That's exactly right. But it is so you don't hyperventilate. That's very good. But it's actually, there is an element of truth to that. One of the things that I think is very important, I think it's important for guys to be in the delivery room with their wives when they're giving birth. And I want to show you how much the world has changed. When I went to medical school back in the dark ages, I was told by Ralph Wynn, a major leader in obstetrical care. He was one of the editors of something called Williams Obstetrics, the book. He said, never let a husband in the delivery room. After all, you are touching his wife.
There you go. You should just talk to my wife and everything would be great.
But I remember thinking, this guy is nuts. He's crazy. I mean, in the delivery room, there's no sex going on at all. It's not his wife. And the fact is, you're there to support the woman when the woman is giving birth.
Yeah.
And it was a very rare event many, many years ago. And now, of course, it's a completely common event. And what we forget is that many guys are frightened about it. They don't know what to expect. There's going to be blood.
You're just killing me here.
Yeah, there's going to be chaos. There's going to be all these things. When, in fact, most delivery rooms have an element of calmness to them. They have an element of comfort to them. There's much more organization that you know and than you initially see. And you do this basically by educating yourself. That's what you do. You have to go to those classes. You have to learn about it. And you can look at as much as you want to. I mean, I remember I delivered about 350 babies when I was doing deliveries. And I had some guys who would be in the delivery room who basically would sit with their wives and would never look down at the baby being delivered until the baby came out.
Because they
just didn't want to look down there. They didn't want to be part of it, and that was fine. That was exactly it.
What's it like to cut the umbilical cord? She wants me to do that, but it's just...
Well, you have two clamps. It's really very simple. There'll be two clamps on the umbilical cord. One will be plastic. One will be metal. The doctor who is delivering the baby will basically lead you to put the scissors in between both clamps. And all you do is cut. They're clamped. The baby cannot bleed out as long as you cut it exactly where they show you. And they go, cut right here. And believe me, they lead your hand right to it. And it truly is a bonding experience. It truly is.
It's been a really fun experience, except for the whole labor room thing.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations. And I was glad that that my advice was able to help you along. And let me assure you something. You are going to be fine in that delivery room. All you have to do is go to those classes and learn how not to hyperventilate, and you'll be just fine, really. You will. Well, thank you for your call.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure. We appreciate it. One of your kids is observing the program, right?
Yes. My daughter, Dee Dee, who's in medical school at the University of Wisconsin. Yay!
She's your favorite?
Of course. I have four favorites, and she's one of my four favorites. That's exactly right.
Okay. 800-462-7413.
You'll get yours on your birthday, Tom.
So what's this about chewing gum being good for us after surgery?
Hey, Mom was wrong. My mother always said, don't swallow chewing gum. Your intestines will be stopped up, and you'll die. Don't you remember that as a kid?
We know that's not true. But who knows? Whoever knew it was good for you?
Well, that's it. My dad was in the chewing gum business with my Uncle Art, and they were he was always bringing me home propaganda from the sugar industry showing that sugar was brain food and chewing gum was good for you. And lo and behold, in the Archives of Surgery, which is a JAMA journal, it turns out that chewing gum is good for you postoperatively. And these were a series of studies that were done with people with what's called postoperative ileus. That's where after you've had part of your colon removed, your gut stops. You've got a nasogastric tube, this little tube in your nose that's sucking out air, and you're on IVs, and you can't eat, and you can't drink, and your stomach sort of bloats up, and it's very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Half the people were given chewing gum, and they were told to chew sugarless gum, no sugar in there. Sorry, Dad. No sugar in there. Sugarless gum 3 times a day for 5 minutes to 45 minutes, okay? So you got to chew it. Just keep on chewing your gum 3 times a day.
All right.
Half the people were not given chewing gum. Lo and behold, on the whole, they had bowel function 1 day sooner. Now, let me tell you, 1 day may not seem like a lot, but when your gut isn't moving,
one day is a lot. That's a big deal.
1 day is a lot, and it was about 12 hours sooner that they started passing gas. Once again, you may not think that's much, but if your gut is out there and you're bloating, 12 hours passing gas sooner, 1 day sooner where your gut is moving makes a big difference. And basically, this shows that chewing gum has a purpose in colon surgery.
So the production of the saliva is what's going on?
It's a lot of things. It's the saliva. It's the air in the saliva. It's the gastric hormones that basically respond to the production of the saliva. It's not the chewing gum. It's all the liquid that's going around the chewing gum, and that basically starts the gut moving. And I think the time has come for surgeons, hospitals, doctors, and nurses to start handing out gum after colon surgery, because this study is really, it's a very good study. It's very well-founded, and I think we should experiment with it more.
Absolutely, should be
done.
Yeah.
And Mom was wrong. Dad was right in my family. Gum is good for you.
In this one instance.
Oh, come on. We can explain this to gum is good for you every day.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener joins in now, Zorba, in Amherst, New York. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have been taking Lexapro for approximately 9 months. It was prescribed by my doctor. I was having some pretty severe panic attacks. I started seeing a therapist, and with that, I made some significant life changes. I cut down on stress, cut out caffeine, started exercising, started doing everything right. But around that same time, I gained weight. I started gaining about 30 pounds. And at the same time, exercised and walked about an hour a day. I'm lifting weights now. And I'm actually afraid to get on the scale. But the only thing I can blame is the medication. And I went online and I'm getting conflicting information. The leaflet that came with the medication is saying it doesn't even mention weight gain. Although I've gone online and people have gained 50 pounds, 70 pounds, and it's a little scary. What is the truth? Does Lexapro and antidepressants cause weight gain, or do they not?
Yeah, before Zorba answers, congratulations on the change of life stuff. That really sounds impressive.
Thank you. You know, I was a big Mountain Dew drinker. I'm ashamed to say how much I used to drink a day, but I cut that out, and I'm eating right and exercising, and I'm feeling great, but the weight gain. So I don't know if I've taken any off, but... It's a little intimidating, but it certainly is worth it.
When we look at depressants as a group, Lexapro and Prozac, they're not known necessarily to produce weight gain. But it's an interesting thing when we talk about weight gain. We gain weight because we eat too many calories and we don't expend enough calories. In other words, there's no pill that actually causes us to gain weight. There are pills that increase our appetite, so we might eat more, or pills that kind of make us tired and lethargic, and we might exercise less. But it doesn't happen without the calories. And the issue with many, many people when they're on antidepressants is they feel better and they eat more. Because for some people, when they're depressed, they overeat. And for some people, when they're depressed, they're undereat. And so it changes that behavior. So the issue really is trying to figure out where your calories are coming from. That's the ultimate goal. Now, getting back to the web, yes, you're going to find websites that say it gains weight, I gained 50 pounds, I gained 70 pounds. But the interesting thing about the web is you've got good information and you've got junk. And you can't differentiate between them. I mean, you can. You know, the Mayo Clinic's going to be a good site, but Ralph's Prozac site or Ralph's Lexapro site will probably be a bad site. And if they're selling you lots of information, you know, and they want you to pay money and they're not giving you value, probably a bad site. But the truth, once again, is kind of somewhere in between. People do gain weight on these drugs, but an equal number of people actually lose weight. So you need to do a calorie count. You need to see how many calories a day you're actually going to consuming. What's your height?
5'2".
So, you know, your calories for a day are about 1,600 calories a day. That's about what you need in order to begin to lose weight. That's not a lot of calories. If you look at, just to give an example, not that you eat at McDonald's, nobody eats at McDonald's who listens to public radio.
Right.
But if you were to eat at McDonald's, a Big Mac, a small Coke, a small fry, that's 1,000 calories. You need 1,600 calories. That's what it is. If you go to a place, we have a place in the Midwest called Culver's. It's fabulous. Their chicken dinner, 1,600 calories. That's the entire amount that you need for your whole day. So what you have to do is you have to figure out a way to look at your calories and cut them down. I recommend a diary. Everything that goes in your mouth for three or four days, see where they're coming from, and then begin to cut it down.
Wonderful. Well, you've been very helpful. I'm going to take your suggestions.
Great. Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Zorba, let's take a moment to grab a quick question now from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Lori in Madison, Wisconsin. Lori writes, I have something strange happening. Maybe you can help. I quit smoking 6 months ago, and shortly after, my fiancé started saying to me that my breath smells like beef jerky. He said he never noticed it until we quit smoking. I take a variety of vitamins and medications. I do not have dental problems, and I regularly see a dentist. I'm not sure if it's my vitamins or medications. Any ideas on what's causing my beef jerky smelling breath?
Well, stop eating beef jerky. I mean, that's the easiest thing in the world.
Not eating
beef jerky. It's not that simple.
Jerky. Right.
Sorry, I thought maybe it was that simple.
No.
There are a few things you can do. First of all, bad breath is not an uncommon thing. It really is a common thing. And there are a number of things you can do to keep from having bad breath. Number one is flossing twice a day. Not once a day, as we know everyone who listens to public radio does. They all floss once a day, right, Tom?
I do. I do. I don't know about the rest of you, but I floss once a day.
Twice a day flossing, electric toothbrush to remove all the debris may be there. Water pick is useful. And then there's a mouthwash called Peridex, P-E-R-I-D-E-X. It is a prescription mouthwash that actually cuts down on the bacteria in the mouth that often cause this. This is basically caused by bacteria that aren't necessarily bad for you, but don't really work very well in terms of the fact that they produce a smell. Peridex, P-E-R-I-D-E-X mouthwash. The other thing is you want to repopulate your mouth with good bacteria. You do that with lactobacillus bacterial capsules that you have 3 or 4 times daily. Or a simpler way is yogurt using live culture. Eat it very slowly and you'll repopulate your mouth. All of those things with the good bacteria will tend to produce a sweeter breath.
Probably while she was smoking, obviously the smoking. Oh,
that's right. It basically covered up whatever else. Because of the stink of smoke,
you couldn't really
smell it. That's exactly right. Don't go back to smoking.
There's no bad breath involved when you send us your emails. Keep them coming. Send your lifestyle questions, comments, and tips to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up next. It's a good one. You'll want to hear that. More of your questions, too, and our medical myth buster later on here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. Caller is waiting, but a line open for you right now at 800-462-7413. But before we get back to the phone, Zorba recipe time, and I am happy to welcome Sandpoint, Idaho listener Mela Bianco Johnson. Mela, hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
Really well. How are you doing, Tom?
Fine, and Zorba's okay, too. It's his birthday, by the way.
Happy birthday, Zorba.
Thank you. I'm 39 today. Yeah. 39, and I've been 39 for years now, so I love it.
Now, how did you come up, Mela, with this, what sounds like a delicious recipe, Mela's cabbage salsa? How'd you come up with this one?
Well, a local restaurant was serving cabbage salsa, a Mexican restaurant, and I liked it so well that I kind of started experimenting and seeing if I could replicate it. And then I came up with this one, which is just a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. We'll find out what ways as we go along.
Yeah, I love salsa. And any variation of salsa is something I really like. So you've been, do you like experimenting with recipes? Is that what you like
mm-hmm.
to do?
I do. Uh-huh. This one took maybe 4 or 5 gyrations before I got it to where I really wanted it.
I love it. That's exactly the way I love to cook. I have 4 children. They all love to cook. I like the concept of you get a few ideas, and then you kind of work on those ideas and come up with a recipe. And I know that Tom does the same thing when he's in the kitchen.
Absolutely.
Home.
Every time I'm in the kitchen, which I can't remember when the last time was. I heard somewhere, Zorba, you may know whether this is true or not. Mela, you may know, too, that salsa is more popular in the United States than ketchup.
Yes. That is the case.
Wow.
That is the case. And that information comes from the Salsa Institute of America.
So
I just
want
to let you know that. So you can trust that. That's right. It's no problem. There's no problem at all. It's not from the Heinz 57 people, but that is true. There's more salsa. It passed a couple of years ago. And those statistics are important. When I first came to Wisconsin, there were more cows than people. Now there are more people than cows. So we know that to be the
Yippee.
Case.
Yippee. Let's put this one together. As Zorba and I will go through this, Mela, jump in whenever you want to.
By the way, Mela, how long have you been doing this salsa?
I think it was last summer. It came to be. So just a couple years.
But this is now you own the recipe. This is yours. In other words, when you have this at the house, people go, wow, this is great. I remember this.
They're starting to like it.
That is great.
Let's put it together.
Okay, start out with 1.5 cups of finely chopped cabbage.
Cup and a half? Finely chopped cabbage.
Now, do you use green cabbage or red cabbage or a combination?
I use green. Just
green
your
cabbage.
Basic green head cabbage.
Uh-huh. Basic green head cabbage. 1 pound of ripe tomatoes seeded and chopped. So, these are fresh tomatoes that you use?
If you can get tomatoes that are in season, that's ideal. But if not, anything from the supermarket will do. And what I try to strive for is a variety of colors. And I like the yellow ones and the red ones, but also my favorite are the orange ones. And in particular, I like to use a kind of tomato called Sun Gold, and they're actually a cherry tomato.
Oh.
And they're bright orange, and they have almost a fruit-like taste. They're very sweet and very mild.
Wow. You know, I've noticed those. I've had those. I know what you're talking about. They almost taste like there's some sugar in them. I mean, that's how sweet they are. Hmm. So when the season is there and you can get tomatoes, you don't just use one tomato. Use several different tomatoes for color and texture and taste.
Mm-hmm. And typically, I'm growing those Sun Gold. So if I've got them and it's the right time, if I can hit it right, I'll use them.
Ah, so in other words, this is for part of the produce you produce at your garden.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Sounds delicious. And then again, the chop is not a dice, but just a chop, sort of a small chop, but not a dice. Not a dice in it. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, for this whole recipe, you can do it pretty much however you want. There's not a lot of rules. So
not a lot of rules.
Feel free.
Sounds perfect. So let's go on. Two small cans of jalapenos.
Two small cans of jalapenos.
1/2 cup of sweet onion minced. Nice minced sweet onion.
1/2 cup of sweet onion minced.
And once again, I might use red onion on there. I might use a Vidalia onion. Mm-hmm. A large jalapeno seeded and diced.
A large jalapeno seeded and diced.
Now, what if you don't take the seeds out, what happens?
I think it becomes quite a bit hotter. Which,
yes,
if
it
you
does.
Like that, feel free.
Yes, it does. It will blow the top off of you because the seeds are the things that contain the heat. Juice of 2 fresh limes.
Juice of 2 fresh limes.
3 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
3 big tea olive oil.
I always use extra virgin. I like the smell of it, the taste of it. Mm-hmm. 6 tablespoonfuls of rice vinegar.
6 big tea rice vinegar.
Okay. Then, now, fresh cilantro, and I take it that you use it when... Do you always use cilantro? I know there are people that love cilantro, people who don't like cilantro.
I always use it. I'm a big fan of cilantro.
Yeah, I like the taste of cilantro, too. So, cilantro, keep it in if you like to. Keep it out if you want to. And then, salt and pepper to taste, and then some hot pepper flakes if you want to even make it spicier.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. So combine, here's how we do it. We combine all of the ingredients in a food processor, pulse until diced. Be very careful. Once again, if you pulse it too much and too long, it'll be it'll basically be all minced up. Very, very simple.
What do you mean pulse it? I don't know what that is.
Why don't you tell them what you do?
Well, there are two levers on the food processor, and one of them is just on, which means it continuously cuts, and it's a pretty powerful option. And then the other one is pulse.
I get it. Yeah.
But I think that's very important, especially if you don't use your food processor as much to realize with the pulse, all you do is go bump, bump. You sort of hit it slightly, and basically it really does a good job, and it keeps it at something that isn't too finely diced.
So I can't make this in my 1971 blender.
No, you can't make this in the blender. It's not going to work. You got it. That's exactly it. Okay, so you put it in the food processor, pulse until diced, pour it into a large bowl, cover, refrigerate overnight. A great idea. Serve it with corn chips, and we're there. It's fabulous. It's 90 calories per serving. Some of it comes from fat. That's the olive oil, which, of course, is good oil. Little bit of sugar, little bit of dietary fiber. Sounds delicious. I'm going to make this tonight. I love it. Thank you so much. It's a great recipe.
You're welcome.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Mila.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Hope you enjoy it.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thanks. For sending us this winning recipe, Mela gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low-Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's really easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
zorba@wpr.org.
For today's recipe, send a stamped, self-addressed, business-sized envelope to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706.
And if you want this recipe to go, just go to our website. You can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's zorbapastor.org.
Is our toll-free number. If you have a question for Zorba, call that number, 1-800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, with a listener now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
Some of my friends decided to go on a health detox, and they described it to me like for a week, 2 weeks or 10 days. They drink nothing but like a concoction of lemon juice and like maple syrup and some kind of spice. And then at the end of, you know, that period, they just rebuild up what they eat. And a few of my friends who just finished it said they've never felt better. And, you know, I mean, I've heard of some other detoxes where people drink nothing but, like, cranberry juice for, you know, a week. And these types of restrictive diets don't seem very healthy. And I was just kind of wondering, you know, is it healthy and are there any health benefits?
Yeah, but they sound very delicious, don't they?
Right, it's the opposite of the Big Mac attack. That's exactly what it's the opposite of. Well, if we look at the history of fasting, it goes back thousands and thousands of years where people go on a whole variety of fasts. Ayurvedic medicine, which is a traditional Indian medicine, Navajo medicine, Tibetan medicine, they all consist of fasts. You know, the concept being that when we simplify our diet, we get rid of toxins that may build up in our bodies. Now, I've never quite understood what these toxins are. There's no scientific basis for toxins. You know, what are they? Are they things that cause cancer or heart attacks? Well, as far as we know, there's nothing, you know, that actually produces that. On the other hand, people who often go on these diets for a day or two or three or four days say, you know, I really feel better afterwards, but they don't tend to repeat them. In other words, they'll do them and then they'll say, well, I should go on one, and they don't tend to do it 3 months later or 6 months later or 9 months later. They often do it once. Mm-hmm. And they go, I've never felt better. And if you ask them 6 months later, are you going to go on the fast again? 9 out of 10 times they'll say, well, I should, but I don't have the time. In other words, they don't do it more than once. Now, if it made you feel really good, there are certain things that make us really feel good in life, like sex. We tend to do it more than once, right? Right? So if these fasts made you feel really good, you would do it more than once. So I don't really know how good it makes them feel. I think they feel really good when they go back to eating. And they go, that made me feel really good, but I'm really glad to get back to eating. So that's my thought on it. It doesn't cause any harm, but there's no scientific evidence that it does any good. My recommendation is do it once, like everybody else. And that's where it fits.
Okay.
But you have to see, on the whole, if you want to feel better, it's exercise. I mean, exercise makes you feel better. And a diet that's more plentiful with a variety of fruits and vegetables will make you feel better. And I think a fast for a day or two are fine, but a week is a long time to fast. That is a long time to go on a quote, toxin-reducing diet. I think a day or two is a totally different issue, but I think a week is rather long.
Okay, so like, you know, a short fast. Eat healthy and have lots of stress.
Yeah, and a short fast can, once again, it just sort of resets your idea. At the end of a fast and you eat, then all of a sudden you realize how good food tastes. I mean, and we have food all around us, so some of us never really taste food because we're never hungry because we're Americans and we eat continuously. Yeah. So,
thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
Interesting to me, Zorba, that a comment that we really don't know what toxins are when we talk about getting.
Yeah, I don't know what these toxins are.
What is that?
Remove toxins from our diet. Yeah. I don't have any idea what that is.
Nobody's ever described what these.
No, what are these toxins? I don't know what they are. Bad things. Evil spirits from our diet. Sorry, I don't mean to be cynical about fasting, but on the whole, I've noticed people do it once.
I know that's interesting.
Some do it twice. Not many.
1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's get back to the Zorba Pastor in Your Health inbox now and help out a listener named Cheryl. Seems Cheryl is in the market for a new bed and wants your advice. She writes, I'm a 47-year-old healthy and active mother of two young children. I'm writing because I experience hip joint pain as I lie in bed, especially on my side. Do you have any tips or resources for selecting the right mattress? Lying on a mattress in the middle of a store will only get me so far. Thanks for your help.
Well, it's true. It only does get you so far. Have you ever gone shopping for a mattress?
We just got a mattress.
Yeah, and what'd you do? You went to a store?
Yeah, you go to a store and you lie on a bunch of beds.
Yeah, in front of everybody else.
Well, this
for
was
5 seconds.
Actually, it wasn't that public, but it's in front of other people.
Yeah, and then you're lying there and you say, well, what's it like
but
after like
it's
10
hard to
seconds?
Decide. Is this one
really
more comfortable
hard.
Than that one, or how do you make that
very
decision?
Yeah. You know, it's not easy. And so then you have a variety of other beds, you know, that you can adjust the firmness of, you know, they get advertised, you know, so
they're
one firmness, somebody else. So you can tell it's not that easy to find the right bed for you.
Right.
You know, when it comes to like finding a blender, you don't hear a lot of people talking about, well, my blender blender is faster than your blender, right. You know, because they all tend to work the same way. Yeah. They're on and off with a variety of different things. So in terms of a mattress, it's a matter of the firmness of the mattress. And what you have to literally do is find the right mattress. I would recommend going over to other people's houses and asking them about their mattresses. That's what I would do. That's a good way of doing it. Because sometimes you'll lay on somebody else's mattress and you'll say, I like that mattress.
What's comfortable for you isn't comfortable for me. This is such an individual
thing. We're not sleeping together, Tom. It doesn't make any difference.
No, but I'm saying the friend's mattress doesn't. That doesn't help because people.
Well, there is no key. You have to go and try it out and see how the mattress works. It's like driving a car and purchasing something else. Yeah. The problem with her, though, is she has joint pain.
Yeah.
Now, most people with back pain do well on a firmer mattress. On the whole, a firmer mattress is better for back pain. Joint pain, though, is a different issue. Sometimes if you have joint pain, you need something that is softer, and so what you get is a firm mattress with a soft covering on top of the mattress that will sort of, you know, will basically soothe the joints initially
pillow
for the first 2 inches.
Pillow top
on top of a firm mattress.
That can be. We've had one of those, and it doesn't. For us, it didn't work.
Now wait a second. Your wife has joint pain. What kind of a mattress do you have? Give her the advice. I'm going to throw this out to Tom. Tom is now going to give you advice on the right mattress to buy. He just bought a mattress. His wife has joint pain. Go for it, Tom. This is your show.
Tempur-Pedic, the second most firm mattress, seems to be working for us. We just got it three, four weeks ago.
And now the disclaimer, you're on the editorial or advisory board for Tempur-Pedic.
No, I'm not. I'm not getting any money from Tempur-Pedic.
Just checking.
Or much of anybody else for that matter. Anyway, good luck. Hey, but luckily, the good news is that most of these places give you 30 days. With a money-back guarantee.
Oh, that is good. So Actually, you brought an important point.
You can buy it and try it out for a while.
But you know what?
You'll have to pay a delivery charge
but
when
that,
you send
but
it
you
back.
But you hit the important point. Make sure you go somewhere where there's a 30-day guarantee.
Yeah. If you have a lifestyle or shopping question for Zorba, we want to hear it.
Or Tom.
Send it to us in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some research coming up, more of your phone calls, and our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again if you have a question for Zorba, 1-800-462-7413. But Zorba, right now, research time. Isn't this interesting? 57% of us say God's intervention could save a family member even if a physician declared treatment would be futile. 57% of us.
That's a large percentage of people in America. And the study also showed that 20% of the doctors and other medical workers, doctors, nurses aides, etc., said that God could reverse a hopeless outcome.
Well, wait a minute. Don't most doctors think they're God?
Yeah, right. This is exactly it, so we can reverse it.
Just joking, most doctors. Not joking about surgeons. Okay, back to our research.
But I think this is an important issue. It shows you there is a point where a faith and a belief system plays a role, or at least is thought to play a role, in the way people think they'll get better or not get better, especially in situations of trauma, situations that are hopeless, end-of-life palliative care situations. They play a role.
Here's more from this. 3/4 of us say if the doctor says, I'm sorry, the treatment can't possibly help, that this would be futile, 3/4 of us say we have a right to demand that treatment.
Right. And that
because
is,
of the possibility and
by
of
the way,
God's intervention.
By the way, that has changed over the last 30 years. 30 years ago, if doctors said this was futile, we're not going to engage in the treatment, people would say, okay. And that's changed because, among other things, patients are now questioning authority all the way through the medical system and saying, even though you think it's futile, we want to take a chance to see that it works. And that becomes a different issue. It's not just a belief issue, but it's a belief that, well, doctor, you're wrong, except excessive treatment may make a difference, but we don't think it's excessive. We think it's appropriate, and there's a different viewpoint
now,
there.
These researchers are suggesting that these results show that doctors need to take this information into account when dealing with patients.
Absolutely. And it really has to do with the sensitivity of what's going on in a traumatic situation, a near-death situation, or a situation after death. Because there are lots of things that go on in terms of guilt and anxiety. I should have called earlier. Why didn't we intervene? There are lots of emotional issues that go on, and there are lots of belief issues that physicians have to become more sensitive to. Frankly, some doctors are sensitive to this and some doctors are not.
Yeah. We don't want to give up hope, do we? We want to hope.
We never do. Even when the situation is hopeless, we don't want to give up hope, because sometimes a hopeless situation has a good outcome. But the other issue that I think that is important is, even giving up hope is bad for you, but even at the time when somebody may be dying and ultimately dies, hope is still very helpful to the families and helps them get through the process, and this study shows that's important.
800-462-7413. That's our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Here's a listener now, Zorba, in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, for as long as I can remember, I've always preferred to dine late in the evening as an immediate prelude to sleep, kind of like a lion after the kill.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really an energetic guy, and I like to cram a lot of projects into a day, so I use a large meal as a sedative to shut down into satisfaction and drowsiness. The issue leading up to my question is that there's a bit of a rift between my companion and me, because she qualifies as normal and would like to eat much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
She claims that going to bed with a full stomach often leads to ache and insomnia and produces a myriad of negative health effects. However, I usually get my way because I do most of the meal planning, and she'd rather it be a mutual experience instead of going solo at a preferred hour.
Mm-hmm.
Common sense tells me that it's probably not the healthiest of lifestyles, but I am learning to compromise somewhat.
But wait a second. The Spanish have that lifestyle. They eat at 10 o'clock in the evening, and they're very healthy people. The statistics in Spain show that they're healthier than we are in America this particular time. So
Wait a minute, Zorba Pastor.
Yeah, yeah.
How healthy is it to have your wife mad at you all the time?
Please continue. Tom brings up a good point. Please go on.
Well, you know what? You said something I wanted to hear, because I have been to Europe, and I'm right at home. I mean, they eat at 10 o'clock.
Yes, but they nap. They nap at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They eat at 10, but they nap at 1. Do you nap at 1 o'clock in the afternoon?
No, I don't.
Uh-huh.
I get up, and I just...
See, you don't nap at 1 o'clock in the... So here it is. You want to eat late. She wants to eat early. By the way, what's late?
You know, the compromise now is like 8:30 to 9, and then I'll even go for a walk with the dog and her, you know, after dinner.
That's... Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And but what time does she want to eat? 5?
6:30.
Oh, that's too early.
No,
it's 6:30.
What are you talking about? That's exactly the right time to eat.
You know, I also have to say, I do work out at the gym regularly, and my vital signs, you know, blood pressure, cholesterol, they're all pretty good. So.
Yeah, except... As Tom says, when mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy around the house. That's exactly
what... Like I said, I'm learning to compromise a little bit.
That's right. But she likes eating earlier. You know, a lot of this is really, you know, like you say, it's kind of a habit situation. I like to cram a lot in the day. It's not unusual for me to eat at 8:30 or 9 o'clock. 10 o'clock in the summer, I do that. But often, you know, it's because it's so light out till the end. Yeah. In the wintertime, it's pretty rare that it's at 10 o'clock. There's nothing wrong with eating late. There's nothing bad for the lifestyle. The only issue is that for some people, if they have GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, where they get acid indigestion when they lie flat in the bed at night, that's an issue. That basically is the only issue that's there. So if your stomach doesn't bother you, if you can sleep through the night, some people do get insomnia because they have a full stomach and they dream about food all night and their stomach is stuffy. If she has that problem, that's an issue. But on the whole, there's nothing wrong with eating late in the evening. And lots of people, like I said, in lots of tropical countries in Europe, they eat late at night because it's too hot in tropical countries to eat in the middle of the day. They often eat when it's more comfortable in the evening, 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. But you've got to compromise. Tom's right. You've got to compromise.
I'm more at home in France and Spain, that's for sure. Anyway, I'm really tickled because we had a bet going on here. So she has to make me my favorite dessert of choice.
Oh, good for you. Late at night.
Yeah,
but, and that dessert of choice?
I think maybe like a double chocolate torte or something like that. Yeah.
Mm. Well, you may have won the bet, but tell your wife that the non-medical part of this team is on her side.
Okay, I will. It sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye.
800-462-7413. Let's get to our medical myth buster now, Zorba. Today's myth deals with those little iPod players that are all the rage these days. You know, the little trinket that you go on endlessly about one of those. Apparently, there was some concern about using these iPods if you had a pacemaker. Is there anything to be concerned about, or is this just a myth?
It's junk. It's absolutely a myth. iPods do not cause problems with pacemakers. Microwave ovens do not cause problems with pacemakers. Being close to the computer screen does not cause a problem with pacemakers. It is a myth. Now, there was one minor study that came out that showed it could be a problem. Believe me, this was immediately jumped on by the medical community because iPods, the thing you call a trinket. And by the way, if we look at the definition of trinket, it is not a trinket. It is an essential part of life. And we do a podcast every week, and we have thousands of listeners on our podcast. Trinket, bah humbug. Bah humbug. Do not cause a problem. And the reason why this is an important issue is they're all around. iPods are ubiquitous in many for many parts of the country.
Yeah.
And basically, it's iPods and cell phones, yeah. And they don't cause a problem. They're not an issue. You don't have to worry about it with your pacemaker.
I understand. My life is not worth living without one of those. things.
Life without an iPod is not a life at all.
Deprived I am. There's nothing else that could possibly
How can you live without
the joy
an iPod?
Of an iPod. Well,
how about radio?
Now there, that's an essential item. Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, send it along to us in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And our next caller, Zorba, is in Crawfordsville, Indiana. Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
Great. How can we help you?
Well, I had a question. I've got two lovely things that I'm dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and that was a lovely trip to get on. And then in the interim, had a child, my first, at age 40.
Oh,
congratulations.
Thank you. But on her third birthday, I had a biopsy done, and I have breast cancer. And my question to you is, the steroids that I sometimes have to take with multiple sclerosis, I do an IV solumedrol drip, and I'm just curious as to how that will, if there's chemo involved, and what's going to not play nice with
the
other.
Well, you had a double hit there with a very wonderful thing in the middle.
Right.
Where are you now with both of those things, the MS and the breast cancer?
I got diagnosed with the MS in 2002, and I have I've had one initial surgery where my doctor thought he was going to be able to get it all and realized that he was not. So next week I'm scheduled for a full mastectomy, and that's kind of where I'm sitting.
Sure.
Right, sure. In the middle of the melee.
Mm-hmm. And were there any positive lymph nodes at all?
That, he will not take one. He's going to take a sentinel node or the sentinel node.
Okay.
While the mastectomy is going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you haven't had any nodes biopsied at this time?
Correct.
Okay. Well, first of all, when we look at breast cancer, I mean, let's put that off to one side.
Sure.
It was detected by a lump or by a mammogram? How was it detected?
It was detected by me discovering a lump, thanks to my 3-year-old for elbowing me repetitively.
And saying, hey, Mom.
Yeah.
Hey, Mom.
And it made me think, ow, What is that?
What is that? So that, but that was good. That was good that you know, basically you picked up the symptoms. Breast cancer for many women is a disease that is curable. For some women, it becomes a chronic disease, and that's how we look at it. We don't look at it as, I mean, we look at it in the proper way of looking at it nowadays, because many women have it and they last many, many years without with being essentially free of breast cancer. And the fact that you now need a mastectomy certainly puts you in a risk group that you, as you know of, that is a bit higher. But once again, it's a function of the nodes and other things.
Right.
And whether you will get radiation or chemo following this is a function of ultimately how they stage the cancer. So that's step one.
Okay.
Now, when you're on chemotherapy, if you're on chemotherapy, sometimes steroids are part of it. Sometimes steroids are not part of it. Sometimes things are adjusted because chemotherapy knocks down the immune system, knocks down the white count, and often we have to be careful. And if you're given steroids too, that also decreases the ability to fight disease. But from a neurologist's point of view, if you have a flare of, you know, of your MS, you want the neurologist to get on the phone and talk to the oncologist. This is no big deal.
Right.
I mean, you know, they get on the telephone and they say, hey, you know, I've got this patient, you have that patient, what are they on, what would you recommend?
Sure.
And it's not a hard thing to do. It's just a matter of sort of gently encouraging that, and it can be done. In-network or out-of-network, it still takes a telephone call. So you want a neurologist and oncologist who can communicate if you have a flare of your MS. That's the issue.
Okay.
If you don't have a flare of the MS, it doesn't matter. But you want to make sure your chemo is done in-network, even if you get a second opinion out-of-network.
All right. And can I just tell you guys that I love hearing you laugh?
Well, thank you. Thanks very much.
They just got such great laughs.
Thanks, and thanks so much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Before we get out of here, Zorba, let's help out a Norman, Oklahoma listener, Judy Reynolds. Seems when Judy's traveling by air, she has a tough time with the landing. She suffers from severe sinus pain only on the way down and wonders what you would recommend.
Sudafed.
If you have a lifestyle question, comment, or tip, then send it to us in an email too.
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Take care, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. If his wife answers, ask for Adam. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of
Got married.
Yes, he did. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Charles Monroe Kane is the executive suit in charge. And Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0808Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.